This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
I'm going to go live. I'm going to do the intro, and we will be right back. Wait a minute.
Did it go well, we're waiting.
With your host, Wayne New, Greg Nalo, and Lou Fass.
Sorry about that. Usually the YouTube thing pops up at the same time. Anyway, we're here. Where'd Lou go now? He's gone again?
Yeah. Wow.
Wow. Welcome to Rat Salary Review. This happens all the time.
I know,
but it's Zoom. Definitely. You know what? Zoom is garbage. I hate Zoom. And it sucks that you pay for it. And this is the things that happen. Oh, he's back now.
There he okay? is.
He doesn't look like he's having a good time over there. Something's going on. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, yeah. Today we're here with Steve Rosen, the author for the book Tone Chaser, Understanding Edward, My 26-Year Journey with Edward Van Halen. Welcome to the show, Steve Rosen.
Hey, Wayne. How's it going? Yes.
It's going very good. I've been reading this book for the last few days, and a lot of stuff I didn't really know about because I just never heard a lot of these stories, so it was very interesting to hear a lot of stuff that was going on during the whole time you were friends with Edward Van Halen, and it's just crazy because I'm a fan of Eddie Van Halen. Lou is a huge fan. He's a guitar player. He's wearing an Eddie Van Halen shirt right there, and
well, not an official one.
Not an official one, but yeah, but he's a huge fan, and it's a really great book. So people, this is actually the second edition, right?
That's correct. The
first edition, yeah.
So I began writing the book, I keep getting my dates mixed up, August 24th, 2020, which was just, a month or so prior to Edward's passing, and, came out with that first edition, 15 or 16 months later, sold that out. And I have been on the second edition now for 3-4 months. And it's been amazing, man. It's been really fulfilling. I mean, a shit ton of work, but, you know, worth every minute of it, to be honest with you.
Very cool. And the book is available on Amazon. So go pick up a copy after you watch this episode because it's totally worth the read. And we'll post the link in the description.
Thanks very much. And Lou, if I could just fill in some of those holes, on Amazon, eBay, Reverb, and Etsy, and my own webpage, which is tonechaserbook.com.
Everybody got that? Good.
And if you don't, it'll still be in the description. Do you go on any tours, like the book signings or anything?
Yeah, man, I'm hoping to put those together. There's nothing on the book. I've done a couple. There's a pretty famous independent bookstore out here on Sunset Boulevard. In fact, it's literally a half a mile away from the whiskey, called Book Soup. And they've been amazing. And I did a signing there, and they've had my book there. And in fact, I was like number two on the nonfiction bestseller list, you know, weeks, and they've made multiple orders. So that's pretty cool. I would love to do book tours, man. I think sitting down and front of people, and you know, they've read the book, or you know, they have, you know, questions. I mean, I really love that stuff. So yeah, so hopefully there's more to come for sure.
Yeah, very cool. Now, has anybody in the family actually read your book and or given you any feedback about it?
What a good question. My brother, Mick, has read the book. Mick was actually there the very first night I met Edward, which was June 1977 at the Whiskey. Cheap Trick was recording a live record, not Budokan, of course, some like promo, you know, live record for the label. And Mick was there that night, and I make him famous. I mention his name in the book. And yeah, he read the book. My brother is my harshest critic. He holds me to a higher level. He's a little too smart for his own good. But yeah, no, he really loved the book, and you know, said some very nice things and pointed things out. And I go, okay, Mick, you know, just tell me how much you like the book. No, I shouldn't say that. No, he was very supportive of the book. Yeah.
Well, and did that bastard teacher of yours read this book? Like, I'm reading a book, and that teacher that you had, I told you couldn't write anything. I mean, God.
But you know nice, what, man? Nice tip of the hat with the long run-on sentence. That was awesome.
Exactly. You know, it's funny, man, because as I was writing that little section, yeah, I was getting out all my vitriol on this freaking dickhead, but you know, I just kept writing. I thought, oh, I'm gonna write this as a run-on sentence. You know, I never really was that smart to think ahead and do that. But you know, I mean, I would wish nothing bad on the guy. I hope he's read the book. I mean, he wasn't that much older than the students in the room, you know, so right. Well, he's probably still around. Yeah, I hope he's read it, and if I could have remembered his name, I may have even have used his name and the whole thing. But yeah, you know, things happen for a reason, or so they say.
We'll just call him Niedermeyer for short. That's okay.
Exactly.
Too funny. All right, go ahead, Lou. I cut you off there, so go ahead.
So first of all, again, thanks for coming on to Ratside Review on this live stream with us, and you know, granting us this opportunity to interview you. Wayne and I read the book, and you know, to call it an emotional roller coaster is a bit of an understatement. But I kind of want to know more about you as well. Like, you mentioned in the book that you were a freelance writer for guitar magazines before you met Eddie. And I guess my question is, as a guitar player, like, I know what drove me towards guitar, but what was it that brought you towards writing about the instrument and the guitarists that were making names for themselves at the time?
Really, that was all born from the fact that I played guitar, and I was not a great guitar player, but my greatest desire was to be in a guitar player in a rock and roll band. You know, I wanted to be a songwriter. I wanted to be, you know, play guitar. As a way, I thought, to maybe break into that place where, you know, you'd be meeting publicists and managers and labels. And that's not the only reason, but I thought, you know, well, maybe if I start writing about guitar players and I'm writing for magazines, I'm now in that same space as them. And maybe I'm, you know, in a room one day with, you know, Peter Frampton, and I give Peter Frampton my little cassette with my songs on it, and he loves my songs, and, you know, I get to go on the road with Peter Frampton and his band. You know, that never happened. you know, it's one of those things where it's almost the closer I got to these guys, and I was meeting these amazing guitar players every day and hanging out at the labels and the management companies. It's like they only saw you as a journalist. And well, yeah, you play guitar and you write songs. Well, that's great. Then why are you in here interviewing our bands and not out there playing? You know, it's one of those things. It's like those who can't teach, which is not necessarily true, but in a more direct answer to you, Lou, I mean, I was an avid reader. I mean, I loved reading. I was reading those early issues of Guitar Player before I started writing for them. I had a big record collection before I became a journalist. I mean, I was listening to all kinds of guitar players. I was playing guitar, and it just seemed like a cool thing to do. I started writing for a high school newspaper, and I would like go to clubs, and I was reviewing shows at the Whiskey, and a lot of clubs that are gone now. Golden Bear, the Ice House out in Pasadena, which probably wasn't too far from where Edward lived. I began probably mid 73. I started writing, and by the time I met Edward in 77, yes, I had written for Guitar Player. I think I'd done some things for Cream and Circus. And I'd met a lot of heavy guys before meeting Ed. I'd met Blackmore right before I met Edward. I'd interviewed John McLaughlin and Joe Walsh, John Entwistle. I mean, I'd done a bunch of amazing interviews before meeting Ed. So yeah, I wanted to be a writer, I suppose, and writing about music and guitar players, I couldn't think of anything more unbelievable to do than that. So.
You're on mute or something. Your audio is not working. There you go.
I only wish I was around at the time that I could have read these, because I was born the year Women and Children First came out. You mentioned Blackmore. Him, personally speaking, Eddie, Tony Iommi, Randy Rhoads, and Blackmore, that's my Mount Rushmore players. So those are the guys that I studied. But bring it back to the time up until you met Eddie. So we're talking California in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, the Whiskey A Go-Go, Gazzari, Starwood. You know, rock music was filling out clubs, theaters, and arenas. Local bands with like Quiet Riot with Randy Rhoads and Y&T with Dave Menichetti. You had the Runaways. And, it's a far cry from today's musical climate where there are no venues or original bands anymore, except exactly. Severed Angel, severedangel.com. Buy our stuff. Thank you. on an international level, you had UFO with Michael Schenker, who personally, I think that if Eddie didn't show up, he might have been the guitarist of the 80s that we might be talking about, but that's a different story. Can you go into a time warp of what the musical and live music climate was like for people that have only heard of it but never experienced it?
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point. It was pretty eclectic back then. So, Van Halen are coming out of the, they're a Pasadena band. They never considered themselves a Hollywood band. But ultimately they grew out of Pasadena, playing those now infamous backyard parties, putting on their own shows at the Pasadena Civic and drawing in 3,000 people. They were ultimately, which is where most bands ended up if they were going to go anywhere, was on the Strip. So you were playing the Whiskey and the Starwood. You started Gazzari's and bounced down to the Whiskey if you were good enough. But they were coming right out of that big punk thing, which I honestly just never got it. I never liked it. You had a lot of good guitar players that were around it. George Lynch and Warren DeMartini and Rusty Anderson, who is now Paul McCartney's guitar player. They were all playing in sort of, pre-Rat, pre-Dokken bands. I was at the Whiskey. I was seeing all kinds of stuff there. Dr. Hook and Black Kangaroo. The punk stuff I avoided. I was invited to that stuff. I just never saw it. But it was pretty amazing. It was a pretty amazing thing. And when Van Halen were signed and they landed their big Warner Brothers contract, that sort of told all these other Strip bands, oh my gosh, those guys did it. Maybe we can do it. Van Halen really opened the door for all of that. But there was a lot of stuff happening. Yeah, Michael Schenker, I think UFO were around, amazing guitar player. I interviewed him, incredible guitar player. It was a pretty amazing scene, and it was a scene for sure. Like I said, I was at the Whiskey 4 or 5 times a week. I was at the Starwood Y&T. Y&T was there famously the night when Ted and Mo Austin, Ted Templeman and Mo Austin from Warner Brothers, came down to see Van Halen. Y&T opened. And I mean, they were like a, they were a perennial there. They were there. I mean, I probably saw them a dozen times. They used to open for everybody. And Dave Menichetti, you know, was an unbelievable guitar player. So yeah, it was a pretty amazing scene. I mean, it was pretty incredible. I mean, it was a fun time to be a journalist. You know, a lot of these bands, you know, you talk about Sanker. I mean, back in 77, 78, 79, I mean, you know, he's just kind of getting out there. So publicists wanted writers to interview their artists, you know, because a lot of these artists were on their first records or second records. You know, I'd interview the whole, all of Aerosmith, because they played the Whiskey. That's the Aerosmith at the Whiskey for their, right after the first record came out. You know, and we all sat around a little table. I mean, it was like, who do you want to interview? You know, it was because all these bands needed the publicity at that time, you know. So it was pretty great.
What I love about the book is that
your microphone tonight, it's like not working,
cutting in and out.
Yeah,
and that's okay.
Okay, am I right now?
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was muting myself. I'll try to mute myself 5 seconds before I talk then. Sorry for the dead air. What I love about the book is that it really captures Eddie in his words, and it really shows how he really felt like a kid in a sandbox when he was talking about his passion, which was guitar, whether he was playing them, modifying them, or building them. However, as the story goes, and I don't want to give too many spoilers away because I want people to buy the book. We want people to read it and support you.
Please.
As they become more financially successful, and when companies realize that they could capitalize from the Eddie Van Halen brand name, a bit of his dark side comes out, which affects his relationships and really shows it kind of shows it in his answers to your questions. And it seems safe to say that Eddie seemed happiest just when he was being creative and not playing the role of the quote unquote rock star mogul. Would you say that's a pretty accurate description?
Absolutely, Lou. And in fact, I think I mentioned in the book, and if I don't, I should have. But it was those first two tours and the first few albums that he was joyful, man. Every moment. For him, again, you know, he's coming out of playing for 200 people at a club on the Sunset Strip to, you know, going out there on the road and opening for, you know, Montrose and Journey. And I want to mention this is after his earliest date with Ted Nugent, and Ed talks about Nugent in there, and I want to make sure to mention that. So, you know, you have him now playing, you know, with some of his idols, you know, so that must have just been an amazing thing. But Ed was never the business guy. He never liked making decisions. And I do write about this. A lot of times Edward, because he didn't like doing that, and part of me understands that, he would take the path of least resistance. And that sometimes came in the form of management, of singers, you know, business decisions, endorsing for guitar companies. You know, I wasn't his business, you know, guy. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't his agent. I wasn't his lawyer. There was a point where I felt that I couldn't step over that line. I sometimes wish I had, or I said something. But yeah, man, he hated that. And when Ed said, you know, he didn't like going out, he didn't. It's not like Ed was out at clubs every night, or he was out at concerts, or hanging out backstage, or doing that stuff, which he could have been. He didn't like it. He was most happy sitting in 5150 with the guitar in his hand and writing and arranging and playing music. I mean, he was that's all he was. I mean, sometimes to the you know, almost putting aside family, you know, just for that moment. I mean, you know, back in the day, I mean, he loved Valerie and Valerie loved him. And of course, when Wolf was born, that was everything to him. But there were moments when everybody just sort of were, you know, set aside while Ed was, you know, composing. But the business side of thing, that being that legend, that guy, whenever I would even sort of hint at that, or Ed, do you understand your own importance or your own legacy? He would get angry about it. He would get upset about it. He just didn't want to hear it. It wasn't important to him. Pretty amazing guy in that respect.
And that's like what you mentioned, like on the first few albums, I can even tell by reading it. He was just so happy and just so into wanting to record and play and make music and stuff like that. And then as, you know, his career starts going on, you can kind of tell he's getting kind of sick of the business kind of stuff, and his attitude's changing a little bit, I can notice. So, yeah, I definitely need to see what you're talking about.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, we all have to understand, and it's probably pretty common knowledge now, though when Ed was telling me back in the day, no one knew about it. And I never wrote about that stuff. And those are all the tapes and conversations I held on to for 17 years after our final, you know, conversation together. He had his issues with band members and I write about it. And for Ed, what was crucial, what was topmost for him was respect. And it really didn't have a lot to do with talent. He wanted to surround himself with talented people, of course. But with him, it was all about respect. And if that meant, hey, I'm out here, you know, working 23 hours a day, I want you working on your craft as well. And when the other guys didn't measure up to that, it upset him, because to him, it was disrespecting his art. Right. Like, you know, I bring all this to it. And if you don't, then, you know, there must be some disrespect there. It doesn't mean as much to you as it means to me. And that brought out some bad feelings in him. And, you know, I write about that. He talks about that. At the end of the day, he loved those guys. He loved those guys in the band, but there were cracks in the armor early on. On the other side of that, Edward was astute enough to recognize you don't change horses in the middle of a stream, or whatever that maxim is. You don't change bass players or singers. That would have been a disaster early on, and I believe it would have been as well. And he was aware of that. But he didn't like that cloak of business guy, you know, legend, decision maker. He would allow other people to make decisions, and I think other people made some incorrect decisions on his behalf. That's what I felt.
Yeah. And I was, like you just mentioned too, some inner turmoil in with the band. And I was shocked at hearing some of that stuff, because, you know, they're seeing all the interviews that I saw over the years with them, they seem like they're brothers and they all get along so well. And like most bands, they would just say, if like, say the bass player is not really working out that well, he's gone, you know, but they always just stuck together. And even though there's somebody has strengths and weaknesses, they all just stayed together and still made the music that they did. And I was just shocked to learn about that. You know, I'd never heard about that before.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. And again, yes, we all know about, you know, Edward's relationship with Dave and Michael, because it's, been on 8,000 internet sites, you know, back in the day when he's telling me this, sort of concurrent with, you know, the second or third record. It's like, wow, are those really your feelings? And, you know, so,
yeah,
it's pretty unbelievable. You know, obviously at the end of the day, it all worked. I mean, those first 6 or 7 records, you know, whatever that is with the original band. I mean, you know, those are remarkable records, and that's an amazing, you know, legacy to put together. Whether, you know, you're, you know, having knockout punches, you know, punch out fights with your other members or not. Not that they did, but, you know, he made it work. He made it work. For sure.
Yeah. Go ahead, Lou.
Cool, thanks. So with all due respect to other publications written about Eddie, I think where your book excels, aside from being the actual words of Eddie himself, is that everything occurs in the book as they sequentially happened in real time, in real life. That being said, it touches on many pivotal points in his life, including the final masters of the albums, which you got to hear before everyone else did, which is sick. I mean, Fair Warning is my favorite album of all time. Yeah. If I heard that before it came out, I'd been like, dude, you know, sorry. Just had to throw that out there. So there was that, the tours as they happened, including the US Festival, the Brian May Starfleet EP, talking about Alan Holdsworth, the 1984 album, the period where a certain Ronald McDonald lookalike becomes their lead singer, but let's not get into that. And the passing of Jan Van Halen, Eddie's father. And it really shows his vulnerabilities where it shows the vulnerabilities within the band, where it even talks about Alex's fits of jealousy and, you know, Ed's feeling the pressure of being the sole creative force in the band. And of course, his marriage to Valerie. You definitely provided a good ear for him to open up his inhibitions to. And I guess you kind of touched on it before that you kind of wish that you would have intervened more if you could have.
Well, you know, man, you really hit on a lot of those key elements. You know, I mean, those are big points, and a lot of those subjects you just bring up, you know, I mean, there's part of me that was hesitant to include that stuff or to write around it. You know, I mean, I could have written a simple book. I mean, I could have put together my interviews and, you know, not written any narrative. I mean, it would have been a simple book to write, you know, but I couldn't do that. I thought that, I just thought it was an important story. And because I did believe that I was pretty much the only person who had that story. Not that I was the only person who hung out with him, but I was probably maybe the only writer who had hung out with him and had all that stuff on tape. So it was important to me to be as honest as I could and to paint myself. And sometimes it's not, you know, remarkable situations either. You know, I mentioned early on about his, I mean, one of those main points that I'm really a little sad that I never really said anything, was his smoking. And, you know, and I write about it from the very first night I met him at the whiskey. He may have had a guitar in his hand every time I met him, but he also had a cigarette. And he held the record. And I've been around some smokers that smoke incessantly. Edward smoked more than all of them. And it was a horrible, horrible habit. And again, I write about being susceptible to migraines. Nicotine smoke, oh my God, man. Back in the days, you'd go to a club right before the non-smoking bands. You know, you'd walk into the whiskey and it would be thick. You'd be like, you know, crawling your way through like fog, man. Restaurants, oh my God, you're trying to eat.
Oh, those are the days.
Oh, yeah. You know, you'd come home and you would just reek. My God, I'd smell myself and I'd get a headache, you know. So, back in the day, I was continually surrounded by it. And with him, you know, Ed would come over to the pad up in the Hollywood Hills, you know, famous Weepaw Way, you know, and you have a cigarette in his hand when he walked in and he's smoking, you know. And all I ever did was give him an ashtray. You know, and like I said, I'm sure I could have said to Ed, man, please don't smoke in the house. And I know he would have respected it, and he would have gone outside. But more than that, you know, I just said, Ed, man, you know, you're such a healthy guy otherwise, you know. And he was, man. You know, I mean, he may have been doing drugs and drinking, man, but the guy was fit, you know. He was ripped. His arms were amazing. He was never overweight, you know. His skin tone was incredible. He always seemed like a very healthy guy. And I knew, you know, not that it took any, you know, magic ball, but I knew that cigarette smoking was going to get to him. I wish I'd said something about that. I wish I'd been more vociferous in talking about when he wanted to endorse Kramer. I'm not talking about the quality of Kramer's guitars. They made great guitars. Obviously, Edward loved them. But there's no way he should have put his name on them. You know, he could have said to Kramer, build me 10 guitars. These are the specs. I'll play these guitars, but I'm not. You're not going to use my name. And I don't know why he did that. At the end of the day, Kramer did some lousy stuff with him. And you've read about that in the book.
Yeah, unfortunately, I read that after I had bought a Kramer already. So,
look, again, man, I'm not trashing the quality of the instruments at all. Obviously, Edward loved what they did. You know, he played those guitars. There's pictures of him with those guitars. It was just, why? Why would you're the biggest guitar player on the planet? They would have done anything. Any guitar company would have done anything. Why put your name on it? I mean, look, whatever money they paid him, it must have paled in terms of the money he was making. So it wasn't about the money, and I can't believe that he wanted it for prestige thing, because that wasn't him. But I thought that was a mistake. I thought, you know, when Sammy came into the band, Sammy brought his manager with him. I don't understand. I mean, why would you do that? And again, I'm not questioning. Is that Ray Daniels?
No, that was Ed Leffler.
Ed Leffler, I'm sorry.
Ray Daniels, who managed Rush at the time, came in after Ed Leffler had passed away. And
right, I'm sorry.
And thank you, Ray Daniels, for doing a great service to our country. Anyways.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And so, again, I'm not questioning Ed Leffler's ability to manage a band. Obviously, he had that all together. But the singer brings his own manager in. I didn't understand it. I didn't get it. You know, why would you do that? Why not go out and find somebody? You know, and like I said, sometimes it was the path of least resistance. And, you know, good, better, and different. Ed Leffler, you know, worked with them, and Ed was happy with them. So, you know, maybe at the end of the day, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I don't know. I just thought it was a little strange.
I would say you know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, we're also talking, this is the same guy who did a guitar solo on the biggest selling album of all time at the time, which was Thriller. You know, he did the solo on Michael Jackson's Beat It and didn't ask for any payment on it. I mean, not even points, not even a percentage on it. And that song, not that Michael Jackson wasn't in the stratosphere already, but I mean,
yeah,
you know, that only escalated his value more. And, you know, here's Eddie, who couldn't put his name on the record because of an agreement within the band. And, you know, what did he get for it? Recognition, but nothing monetarily. And he said he did it because he wanted to. But, you know, again, I can understand that, because playing is his passion. I think he was just happy to do it. But, you know, I mean, it's a shame that people took advantage of his kindness. And, you know, and unfortunately, we see as the story unravels, that definitely affected him.
Absolutely. And so where is management at that point? You mean they knew nothing about that? I refuse to believe that. Or they didn't find out quickly enough to say, hey, Michael's on Sony or Columbia, whatever that was, you know.
Yeah, he was on Sony.
Sony. But I mean, you know what I'm saying. So I don't know. I don't, you know, and yes, it goes to Edward's not understanding that, yeah, him playing on a Michael Jackson record and you know, for him, yeah, it was just what he loved to do. And I don't think he recognized the import, again, of who he was or what that meant, or his legacy before all that, you know. I mean, part of it's charming, and part of it's, wow, this, you know, there was a big check that went uncashed there.
So, mm-hmm.
You know.
Go ahead, Wayne.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, you're the one, the Van Halen guy. Go ahead, do your questions.
All right, I just remember, this is your show. I'm not trying to usurp
it. If I think it's our show, it's our show. If I think of something, I will jump in, but go ahead.
Isn't he a great partner,
I'll let you take
Steve?
Over here.
The best.
Now you're fired. You're fired.
All right, I'm back. so it's great for me that you mentioned Alan Holdsworth in the book. Like many other guitarists, I would have never have discovered it if it wasn't for Eddie's championing him, you know, and his music. And unfortunately, he did pass away before Eddie did. But I don't think you could have picked two guitarists who better represented the ones that they influence in their respective genres, both in jazz fusion and in hard rock, the way Alan and Eddie did. But Eddie's always been quoted as saying that he was aware of his influence on other guitarists, but felt resentment that they were too busy copying him rather than finding their own voice. And as someone who experienced those words coming to fruition, especially after he passed, and I'm calling out all you guitar player schmucks out there, I think it's ridiculous when people started buying EVH and MXR gear thinking that you could duplicate him. Newsflash, you can't. Anyways, but time has obviously been the great decider, as Van Halen has had two diamond selling albums, while the ones he influenced may have only gone gold if they were lucky. Do you personally feel that the what we call the six pack, the first six albums, the first six albums that done with the original lineup were probably their most creative? And what do you think kept him from believing his own hype back in the day? Sorry if that's a bombshell question.
No, that's great, man. Look, you know, the feud, you know, Dave versus Sammy will go on forever. And maybe that's a good thing, you know. Some people love the Sammy Hagar era, some people love the Dave era, some people love the Gary Cherone record. Certainly those first six records. The Sammy records, I mean, they're very good records. I mean, they sold incredibly well. But at the end of the day, I mean, the original, you know, those original four guys, I don't know how you really try to put anything up against that. How did Edward not believe his own hype, man? It's a question I tried to answer for 580 pages. You know, how could this guy be who he is and just not have that ego thing or believe all that stuff? It was amazing. And it comes out time and time again in these little, you know, peaks and valleys, you know, things he would say. And, you know, if I told him, my God, and I remember, man, it was the Fair Warning record. And I think maybe that's my favorite as well, man.
Nice.
You know, we're talking about one of the solos, and it was just, you know, one of those life-changing, groundbreaking solos, you know, and I just couldn't contain myself, because I had to contain myself. And I found out early on, man, if I started gushing, man, and if I was a Psycho fan, and I said, Ed, oh my God, that's so fucking, he would like, he'd turn off and I'd go, yeah, man. And like I said, he would almost get angry about it. So I tried to control myself, but this time I went overboard and he kind of got it. But then there was another solo and I thought, well, man, I can't go overboard again, you know. And he was talking about the solo. I goes, yeah, man, it's good. When inside, I want to say it is the greatest solo I've ever heard in my life. It is everything any guitar player, you know, would have ever aspired to. And I said, it was good. And he goes, well, he said, and I can't remember his exact response, and then I read about it. He goes, well, didn't you think it was good? I thought it was good. Meaning, my response to him, he cared so much about what I thought that he thought that I somehow didn't like it. Mm-hmm. You know, Edward Van Halen, it's like, I could have said everything, Ed, you did is horrible. And that he might have really taken that to heart. So I don't know, man, how could he not believe his own hype? He was really, you know, I know I'm jumping around here. I just did a Ted Nugent podcast, and that was fun. And Ted, who knew Ed pretty well, you know, there's some pictures of them on the online, sort of described Edward as a savant. And in ways he was, man. You know, he was this guy who was so unbelievably gifted as a musician. But in those other areas, you know, the business thing, this and that, you know, a little unsure. So I just don't think that the ego thing or that it just never was a part of it. With him, it was just making music. And I always said he was aware of how good he was. He just never needed to hear it. And he would never tell you how good he was. I never, ever heard him say, man, is that the fucking best solo you've ever heard? Man, I can smoke all these guys, you know. He may have had some not so nice words about some players because maybe they had, I don't know, insulted him earlier or ripped him off in some way, but it was never like, oh, that guy sucks, he's horrible, I can, you know, I'm much better than Tupler. You know, I mean, I wish I had a more definitive answer of how he was able to maintain that, but I don't. And as time went on, I think maybe that got a little bit more difficult to balance. And, you know, you touched on it, Lou. Ed got a little darker and you know, a lot of that joy went out of him. And I sensed it over the years. And I never really knew an exact reason why. And I try to answer those questions. But it was a little sad to see that, for sure.
I understand. Well, you answered that question beautifully. Thank you. I first heard of you when you had posted that audio from the Diver Down period.
Oh.
And I think what really hit me about that interview, other than him just having like a conversation with you, was where he discussed Randy Rhoads, and he mentioned that Randy tried to copy him. It's true that Randy taught his students Van Halen music because they asked him to teach them when he was a teacher at his mother Dolores' school, Musonia, where he was then replaced by future docking guitarist George Lynch when Randy went to join Ozzy. It's sad to notice that Eddie never acknowledged that in regards to Randy, because, you know, the debate ridiculously still goes on to this day over who was better, Randy or Eddie. In my opinion, I don't think you could find two different guitarists that had an equal level of importance. But as a fellow guitar fan, where do you stand on the supposed Randy-Eddie debate?
You know, man, that's so interesting you bring that up. And that's one of my great regrets. And that little excerpt you pull out is the only time I ever brought up Randy's name. Edward never brought up Randy's name, you know, apropos of nothing. It's not like, you know, Edward had ever mentioned his name. We were just in the middle of having that conversation. I think we were all over the road and, oh, what about Randy Rhoads, you know? And as you said, Edward said, yeah, he respects me, but, you know, Randy, you know, admits, you know, copying me or whatever that quote was. I'm not sure if you know, Lou. I actually wrote a book on Randy Rhoads.
I need to buy that.
And actually that book, I'll just veer off for a second here. That project was presented to me. It's not like I went out and I was going to write a book on Randy Rhoads. And Andrew Klein, who approached me, was a student of Randy's and knew Randy pretty well. He wanted to put this book together, ultimately put together this beautiful oversized hardcover coffee table book. And he had sort of written a foundational manuscript. And he needed somebody to kind of, you know, put some finishing touches, so that's what I did. I never met Randy. I never interviewed him. I saw him play a couple times with Quiet Riot at the Starwood. And to be completely transparent, I didn't think Randy was that good. You know, he was playing a Les Paul at the time, and he was a good rock guitar player. I couldn't see past it. I wasn't a big Quiet Riot fan, so that may have colored my thinking. And it wasn't until Ozzy, and all props to Ozzy, you know, and now Randy can, you know, he's Blooms and he's triple tracking his solos. And, you know, that's where I thought Randy really came into his own. In terms of that feud, I've heard a lot of different stories. Andrew, like I said, knew Randy. He knew a lot of Randy's friends and you know, I wish I talked to Edward more. I wasn't going to write about something as hearsay. I don't know. I mean, I suppose if Randy were still here, Randy, it would be this incredible compliment to Randy that Edward would feel that way, because Ed never felt that way about any other guitarist. In other words, for him to not dismiss, but not maybe not give Randy his props was another way of saying Randy is a really good guitar player, and you know, I'm, you know what I mean, it's so I don't know. I wish I could talk more to the point, but I heard there were moments when, you know, they'd sort of ran into each other, and those encounters weren't always pleasant. It's strange. I can't imagine. I mean, it's like, I mean, what's that like? Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page? I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know if Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page are best friends. Certainly, they've always had a relationship.
Well, one has passed away, so I don't think that matters anymore.
That is very true. So, I wish, you know, there are moments, there are subjects I wish I could have talked to him more about. Randy certainly would have been one. Alas.
Yeah. Go away.
You did mention the Dave and Sammy thing. What did you really think about when David Lee Roth was gone and then he brought Sammy in and the whole music really changed? You know, it wasn't like it was on the first few albums. So what did you really think about that whole thing?
Right. So I write about that moment in between, that space in between Dave and Sammy. You know, Edward, you know, says to me, "Hey, man, go find me a singer." I go, "You know, right, Ed, yeah, I'm going to find you a singer." Like, you can't find a singer. But it goes to what we're talking about earlier about Edward, you know, not wanting to go find a singer, not understanding the process. Look, I'm postulating here, but I mean, my God, he could have called. I mean, who wouldn't want to be a singer in Van Halen? I mean, come on.
Right. He wanted Patti Smyth, for God's sakes.
Which, yeah, exactly.
Phenomenal, you know, singer, but I don't think that would have been the right fit.
No, I don't either. So, you know, he said, go find me a singer, you know. So, I kind of half-heartedly. If I'd known he was going to be more serious, I would have more seriously pursued it. But so he leaves that message on my phone. Hey, Steve, you know, Sammy's lyrics to my music, man. I forget what he said. Next level or you won't believe it. Funny enough, I had actually interviewed Sammy right before I met Ed, obviously in Sammy's solo career. But I thought the guy was great. I mean, very cool guy, nice, bright. I love the first Montrose record. You know, I was never a big Sammy Hagar solo fan. Yep, talented guy, you know, had great chops and good guitar play. It wasn't my thing. I saw those records as, you know, some of the jagged edges had been smoothed down.
Right.
You know, Edward's, you know, the sound of his guitar changes, you know, and Ed talked about his time, his range is certainly bigger than Dave's. There's more keyboards coming into play. The music is a little more, well, maybe a lot more arranged. You know, the changes are a little more, maybe a little hipper than those first, the canon of those first six records. I mean, they made some good records, you know. I personally thought those first records were better than the Sammy era records, but that's just me, my opinion. And again, you know, when the honeymoon began, that was a big love affair. I mean, you know, they both loved each other and loved working together. And I think Ed loved the idea that he was a guy really devoting time and energy and coming in and all that. And I'm not saying Dave didn't do that, but, you know, I write about Dave going off on a vacation for 2 weeks when he was supposed to be in the studio. Those little bits, you know, Sammy wasn't doing that. Ultimately, some of that started creeping in and, you know, that love affair ends. So, look, no one was going to have the work ethic that Edward had. It was impossible, you know. Right. But, yeah, I mean, you know, Edward found Sammy through his mechanic. Okay. I mean, sure, you know, why not, you know.
Was there somebody you had in mind that maybe would have fit better?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, you know, and I've been asked that. And no, there's nobody specific. And what I thought, and this is, people say, "Oh, dude, you're out of your mind. That was never going to happen." I thought that they could have found some unbelievable unknown singer, some guy who, you know, had all those qualities that Dave had and you know, what Edward was attracted to in Sammy. And just energy and some kid willing to work harder than Edward, you know, was going to be there 24 hours a day. Obviously, Warner's wasn't going to allow that. They weren't going to let him, you know.
I got it. Mike Starr from Steel Panther. He would have been perfect.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, he's like 5 years old by then.
Maybe. Well, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. But no, I never really envisioned any singer. You know, I don't know. I mean, Edward loved Bon Scott, you know?
Mm.
And, you know, I think I'd once compared Dave to Bon in as much as some of that growling thing. And I think they were mad at me for making it too.
The swagger, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know, you know. But then he loved Cheap Trick, and maybe he loved, singer's name in Cheap Trick.
Robin Zander.
Thank you.
Robin Zander, who's an unbelievable singer. But
agreed.
That's the other side, right? That's a little bit, you know, that's like more Sammy, you know what I mean? More that, just an amazing singer, you know?
Yeah, it's it's hard to think because, like, and he mentions it in the book as well, Eddie Van Halen. A lot of people think they're a metal band, but they're really not a metal band, and they could kind of fit in almost anything in a way, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to think like what kind of singer you're going to put with them, because you can't put a metal singer in them because it's just not going to work. You know,
Paul Rogers would have been amazing. You know. Is Freddie Mercury going too far? I don't know. Peter Gabriel, Bryan Adams, I don't know. Yeah, you're right. But
yeah, that's the misconception. I mean, even I would agree. Van Halen was not now, nor were they ever a metal band.
No.
You know, even Dave said that they were a big rock band. He called them bigger than life, but loud in your face rock and roll, and that's what they were. Personally, I think it would have been cool to have seen Peter Gabriel and Eddie Van Halen do something, because I know Eddie was a big fan of the So album, as I am as well. So that would have been, it would have been cool to have heard Eddie collaborate with different singers and see what they could have done with his music. That would have been great.
Could you imagine him up on stage dressed up as like a big flower or something?
Exactly.
We're not talking the Genesis era, dude. We're not talking the Genesis era.
Peter I can't Gabriel. See that.
Yeah, exactly. No, man. You know, and we all now know famously of that A Border to Town, Edward wanted to do been thinking about a solo record, bringing in different singers, and you know, Phil Collins. My God, that could have been unbelievable. You know, because all those guys wrote. I mean, Phil is such an amazing writer. Pete Townsend is the one I really wanted to hear. You know, you hear a lot of Pete Townsend playing it and Edward's playing, and I think I bring it up at one point, compare a song to a Who song or something, you know, one of my moronic statements, but you know, they were a big Who guy, Who band. I was a big Who fan, you know, and you know, in there I write, Edward used to sing Young Man Blues, you know, back in the day, club days used to do that, you know, but he and Townsend writing together, oh my God, that would have been scary. I think Joe Cocker was mentioned, Patti Smyth. That could have been amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Also because of the writing talent of all of those people, it would have been would have been amazing.
Yeah, that's a definite what if question.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
So there have been a lot of books written about periods of the career and lives of the members of Van Halen. Definitely want to give credit to their former manager, Noel Monk, and his book, Running with the Devil. Greg Renoff's Van Halen Rising and Andrew Bennett's Eruption in the Canyon. A lot of what is printed in those books corroborate with events that you, Steve, wrote about in Tone Chaser, from their beginnings to their quote unquote fall from grace. I know as a journalist, you care about your integrity, as it shows in the book. And there's always a factor of asking yourself if there are ever any portions of the story as it happened that you should have left out for posterity, or leave it in there with the possibility of potential backlash. But again, I praise for your honesty in the book. So, you know, might be a silly question, but I'd have to ask, how important was it for you to maintain journalistic integrity and transparency in your book?
You know, those are all such lofty phrases, Lou. And I never thought of myself as a trained you know, journalist, and I write up, you know, we talk about me flunking out of UCLA and wanting to stab the English teacher in the eye with a fork, you know.
Oh, Abdullah Butcher, Wayne.
Yeah, man, you know, and you talk about those other books, you know, and those guys in terms of, yeah, historically, you know, understanding Van Halen. I mean, Greg Renoff, I mean, knows way more about Van Halen than I do. He just doesn't he just didn't have the personal thing, you know. It was critical to me, and I touched on it before. I could have taken the easy way out. I had all these interviews that had never been seen or heard. And even the interviews that were out were edited, you know, for the magazines, you know, there was stuff that was left out. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have put those all together and not written any of this stuff and written a few words as connecting tissue. And you know, it would have been okay. It would have been an interesting book. But, you know, I started writing and then I would come to one of those moments or he would say something and it's like, yeah, what do I do? You know, because if I leave that out, well, when I come to the next little subject, what do I do? Do I leave that out as well? And at the end of the day, I couldn't do that. Not that I was trying to be some, you know, scholarly writer or, you know, the last thing I wanted to do was hurt anybody or reveal something or cause emotional duress for anybody, family members or fans, you know, that's the last thing I wanted to do, you know. I mean, if you read the book, I think you get the sense that it's 580 pages of me paying homage to my friend and, you know, the most amazing guitar player in the world. So I had to include those moments. And like I said, you know, I also had to be honest with myself and, you know, and I'm up there 5150 and we're doing drugs. I mean, I'm doing drugs with Edward. You know, and I drank a little bit, not much because I tended to get headaches, but I had to include those moments because those, I think those moments say as much about Edward as, you know, him building his guitars and playing and his love of music. I mean, there's those little glimpses, you know, that would happen once in a while that tended to be maybe more personal, him talking about his family or his relationship with his brother. You know, those I think really revealed so much about him. So I had to include that. And at the end of the day, I'm really happy I did. The response has been just overwhelming. I have always tried to bring the reader in to my little world. And back when I was writing for Guitar World and doing those Van Halen stories, I put my address in there and please write to me. And what do you think? Do you like the story? And you know, did I do okay? And this and that, you know, and people wrote and I answered every single letter, you know, that was important to me. And so the responses I've gotten have been, wow, I didn't know that about Ed. Thank you for writing that. I don't think a single person has said, why would you write that? Why would you say those terrible things about him? You know, I don't think one person said that. I think one person wrote, well, who the fuck are you, Steve Rosen, to write this book? All right, you know.
You're the guy that interviewed Eddie Van Halen as per his request. I mean, what the hell?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I let that one go. But, you know, the other 99% of everybody, you know, were really happy to read those moments. So I'm happy I wrote that book. It wasn't easy to do. And again, the last thing I'd ever want to do and would ever want to do is hurt somebody, embarrass somebody, you know. If I thought I was going to do that, I would have left those parts out. If I had been contacted by someone who's saying, oh, I understand you're writing a book. And if Edward said, you know, I would have left those parts out. I would have acceded to their wishes. You know, I'm talking about family here. But, you know, I've had no communication with them. And so, yeah, I if they've read the book or if they know about the book, I hope that they're okay with it. You know?
Well, I think what you did was you showed Ed's humanity in the book, because I think you know, people are under the facade that because he was who he was, that he was this, you know, rock god, this guitar god. And, you know, people forget, you know, he was just a human being. He was just a normal guy who, you know, picked up the ball and carried it with him and carried it with him until he drew his final breath. And, you know, I think it showed the humanity of two friends just having good conversations. It showed the, well, cloudy, dirty world that is the music industry, especially at the time, and some of its, you know, unethical tendencies back then and how it could affect a person. You know, I don't want to say that he was a victim of anything, but he was definitely an unfortunate casualty of what could have been. I mean, not that he had a bad career at all. I mean, you know, the man won, you know, guitarist of the year in almost every publication for how long, you know, up until God knows when, and, you know, well-deserved as well. But, you know, like I said, I think what you did with this book was you showed his humanity, which I think is the thing that was lacking in everything else that's been published about him.
That's really nice you said that, Lou. I had an email from somebody and they said, yeah, man, you humanized Edward. I thought, wow, I love that, man. So hearing, you know, because that wasn't, when I set out to write the book, I'm just writing and, you know, I'm friends with this guy. It's not like I said, oh, I want to show that other side of Edward. I want to humanize him. I think if I set out to do that, it wouldn't have worked. So you just kind of stumble upon that by revealing these moments and some of the more personal moments, is that, yes, that humanity and that humanization of this person comes out. So that's great, because at the end of the day, that's really what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted you to know who this guy was, not on stage and not being Eddie Van Halen, but Edward Van Halen. And yeah, this guy who had, you know, insecurities and his foibles and was unsure sometimes and had arguments. And yeah, as hard as it is to believe of our heroes, I mean, they do go through those moments, you know.
Yeah.
Really amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I always try to take into account that every musician or every person that we interview on Rat's Live Review, you know, it's like, you know, yeah, I acknowledge your greatness, but, you know, treat them like how they would like to be treated, like a human being, you know? So it's good to know that you were doing that back in the day. I guess
I'm still waiting for you to recognize my greatness.
No. I'm in a band with you, Wayne. That's good enough. Anyways, severedangel.com, ladies and gentlemen. I what is the takeaway that you personally want people to conclude with upon reading Tone Chaser? Because, you know, like you said, it wasn't like you were trying to humanize him. It just happened that way. But I mean, what's your ultimate takeaway for people?
We talk about those other Van Halen books and those other authors. And I did know that it wasn't going to be that type of book, because those guys know infinitely more about, you know, what guitar did Ed use on the third tour? And, you know, he was using the Duncan pickups and the Bumblebee. You know, although I've had 1,000 conversations with musicians, I understand that on a sort of an overarching plane, but I'm not a tech guy. So, you know, I can't talk about stuff like that. The history of the band, you know, again, was best covered by those guys. So I know it wasn't going to be that kind of a book. That I specifically knew. What would I want people to come away with? That there was this guy, Steve Rosen, who had the, you know, dumb good luck, you know, destiny. I don't know if I've ever believed in that word. I think we make our own way in the world. But I was there that night at the Whiskey, and Edward was there that night. And I write about that. Well, what if I hadn't been there? Would we still have met up? Probably. I mean, somewhere down the line, I probably would have interviewed him, but it could have been then, you know, writer and, you know, interviewer and interviewee. So, you know, maybe the friendship never develops. But so there's this Steve Rosen guy, who's a writer who loves guitar players, who's met a lot of famous guitar players, and he has this amazing opportunity, synchronous events come together, and he gets to meet this guy, Edward Van Halen. And this guy, Edward Van Halen, sees something, feels something in this guy, Steve Rosen, that he feels comfortable with. At the end of the day, I don't think any of that relationship would have mattered. I could have been writing cover stories for Rolling Stone and written 100 books. I don't think any of that mattered to him. And like I wrote, I don't know if Edward ever read a story I ever wrote. But I think at the end of the day, and I talk about it before about respect, I think he respected me, and I was a sympathetic ear. I've always been a good listener. What is a music journalist besides sitting in a room and listening carefully to what these creative individuals are telling you? So that was at the heart of it. And so I would want people to understand, it was a friendship between this guy, Steve Rosen, who never in a million years could have ever thought he was going to meet the most famous guitar player on the planet. And this most famous guitar player on the planet becoming friends with this Steve Rosen guy. And what was that like in those moments, hanging out with this person who was a legend in his own time? And, do you feel that feeling, when I'm there in the room with him and he's playing those licks from the Women and Children first record, and he's playing Van Halen 2 licks, can you feel what I felt and how amazing that was? And, how remarkable and how generous and open and supportive this guy was to this Steve Rosen guy, And that's who this Edward Van Halen was, and that's what I hope people would come away with. And, yes, he changed, but, I try not to remember those years, and I almost discount those because of those first years. He was an amazing person, man. And I love the guy, and he loved me. And, I hope people get that, there's two friends, and I'm reading these words, and I'm sitting there in the room with this Steve Rosen guy, and I can feel that, that's what I hope they come away with, it's hard to really encapsulate it, because there's a lot I hope they come away with, but it's just that, everyone's a human being. I was the luckiest person in the world to have met him, and honestly, I think about it, and I always ask the question, why me? And then the other side of me says, well, why not me?
There you go.
So, I hope people understand that I was the most insecure person. Ed was the most secure person in some ways. And, you come together and this friendship got formed.
Well said.
Yeah. I reading your book, I just found it so cool that he would just show up at your house randomly and just play you the things that he recorded. It was just amazing. Yeah. So
that was amazing.
He really thought a lot about you, apparently, to do that, because I'm sure he didn't do that with everybody.
I don't think he did that with anybody else.
I have to believe that because you're right, Wayne. Lou, I can't believe he was inviting all his buddies over and playing them rough tracks with guitar and drums on it. I just refuse to believe that. And he certainly maybe. Can't believe he was driving over to their house and bringing guitar and playing the riff.
Yeah. So yeah, he took the time to do that. Not everybody's going to do that. It's it's out of their.
I know.
They got other things to do, and then to stop what he's doing and to come over and show you all that stuff.
I know. I know. It blew me away. I thought, my God, for him to do that, and to share his art, the thing that he loved most in life, with me. So I tried to write about those moments, and I hope I captured that moment in words, accurately.
Definitely. Definitely.
So a listener, John Gervais, had two questions. I think you touched on one
we
of them.
Listeners?
Yes, we do have an audio podcast out too, available on Spotify, Amazon, and Apple. And don't forget severedangel.com.
Anyways. Actually, the biggest one that we're listening to on is Pandora. So anybody listening on Pandora.
Who the hell still listens to Pandora?
I don't know, but it's the most thing we're listening on. So
do they still use iRivers? Anyways, moving right along.
What the hell it is?
That was a failed attempt at a competitor for the iPod. Anyways, remember that, ladies and gentlemen?
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Now, yeah, yes. I forgot what it was called. So the two questions they had to ask, I think you kind of touched up on it, but, you know, you did mention the book that you had a run-in with Valerie on the streets as you're running your book, but you haven't spoken to her or Wolfgang about the book?
I have not spoken to Valerie, Wolf, or Alex. You know, I mean, do they know about the book? Probably, you know, I mean, you know, Wolf is pretty active on social media. Maybe he's seen a post for the book.
He's too busy facing off haters. That's what he's doing on social media. Well, a poor guy.
You know, the things that have been said about him are horrific.
Yeah.
And those people need to be strung up, you know. I mean, you know, and I write about it in the book, you know, Edward plays me, you know, Wolf is 11 years old. He's playing drums like John Bonham. I mean, the kid, has Van Halen blood for sure. I mean, mm-hmm. Very, very talented.
I just saw him in concert at MetLife Stadium opening for Metallica. And I have to admit, him and his band were phenomenal. And the songs came off great live. And, you know, like, you know, he did the two-handed tapping, but you know, it wasn't like he overdid it. You know, he's definitely not trying to be his father. He's trying to be his own guy, and I have all the respect in the world for him for that.
Yeah, you know, I do too, you know. And you know, like I said, the last thing I wanted to do was hurt anybody or embarrass mm-hmm. anybody. And you know, I mean, in a perfect world, and I've maybe spoken about this before, I would, you know, I have this fantasy that the phone's going to ring and Wolf is going to call. And, he's going to say, well, I haven't read your book. I've heard about your book. But I understand you were friends with my dad, or you knew my dad for 26 years. And obviously, I knew his dad before Wolf did. You know, what can you tell me? You know, because Wolf seems, you know, I mean, like, you know, he wants to know about his dad and remember things about his dad. And, you know, I can tell him things about his dad in 77 and 78, you know. So, yeah. And, you know, Alex, you know, there's that little mishap in the book with Bon Jovi and. You know, is he still angry at me because of that? I don't know. And Valerie, you know, who I always loved and we got along and playing Scrabble with her was one of the greatest moments of my life. And I loved her and I thought she was always welcoming to me in her home. I think she knew I was never going to do anything to hurt Edward. And, you know, so I don't know, man, sometimes life doesn't work out like you would hope it would. I hope if they know about the book, they feel okay with it, they in deep in their hearts they know that yeah, Steve Rosen is not going to write a book that's going to trash my father or my husband or my brother. You know, I hope that they would know that. And
spoiler alert, he didn't.
Yeah, it's a very respectable book,
so. Absolutely. But we'll always love Barbara Romano anyways, so that's great. A one day at a time reference for you youngins out there. That's when we all first heard of Valerie.
I mean, who didn't love her? I mean, my God, the first time, you know,
Dave.
Yeah.
God. The second question is that John asked was, what is, you mentioned Fair Warning is your favorite Van Halen album. What is your favorite Van Halen song?
Oh man, that's so hard. You know, it's funny because maybe my favorite Van Halen song is off the first record is Jimmy's Crying.
Really?
Yeah. I just think it's one of those songs. it's one of the overdubs on the first record. There's only a couple songs in Talking About Love, I think, you know, where he's actually, you know, he's playing a rhythm part and then he goes back into the solo part, or the noodle part, what I call. And then towards the end there, you know, it's the riff, and then he does like that Hendrix two-string thing. I just thought that was so amazing. I thought Dave sang really great. The riff itself, I just thought was unbelievable. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm on fire. It's like,
that's my personal favorite song.
You know, my God, I've talked to a lot of guitar players, and certainly you recognize it, Lou. And they said that's maybe one of the most difficult songs to play because of Ed's feel.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know that because I have to play it next month.
Oh, wow. Cool, man. You know, so Ed had that swing that a lot of English guitar players had, which is why I love English guitar players, you know, but Ed's rhythm playing was just, it was astonishing. And, you know, that's an unbelievable example of that. So.
Yeah, he does not get enough credit as a rhythmic player because, no. You know, what he does is he plays the guitar like it's its own voice, you know, mm-hmm. like instead of just doing, you know, typical power chords or like, you know, arpeggiated note picking. I mean, he's doing stuff that I'd hate to say it, but it's true that almost everybody else in the 80s completely mimicked.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you think about it, you know, Van Halen is a trio with the singer. So it's not like there's another guitar player there. You know, it's not like there's a keyboard player. Yeah, so for him to have developed that style, you know, this is maybe apropos of nothing, but I've always wondered, how is it that someone like Edward Van Halen, and I suppose you could say this about, well, you couldn't say it about Jeff Beck or Jimmy Page, because those guys grew up out of the blues. So there's the slow evolution. But how come Edward Van Halen, we couldn't have heard about Edward, and maybe he was playing those backyard parties, but why wasn't Edward around in 70? Now, the age thing, I understand, but how is it that Edward developed this style in, you know, 73, 74, 75, and it wasn't around in any form before then? And it was Where does that come from? You know, I guess I'm looking for what's the speed of creativity. I don't know if there's even an answer for that.
Could I interject?
Yes.
I think it's because doing those backyard parties in Pasadena, they had to do 3 to 4, sometimes even 5 hour shows where they had to learn a bunch of songs. So what's Ed going to do? He's going to sit down, hear them on the radio or hear them on the record, play along with them and play what he thinks they're playing. So I'm thinking that that's what evolved into his own style. You know, they say that 10,000 hours of practice makes you ready. And, you know, what else was he doing other than getting ready to play those backyard parties? So I'm thinking that that had everything to do with it. Because when I first started out, you know, I had a Mel Bay book like every other aspiring guitarist does. Yeah. But then all of a sudden you develop the Suzuki method, you know, playing by ear, and you are playing what you think you're hearing. Hmm. And I think that's possibly a big part of it. I could be wrong, but it's just a hypothetical guess.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, playing what you think you're hearing. Now, that's a pretty whimsical notion, but I totally get it. You know, so we're talking about creativity and where does that come from and what is it you're hearing and how did you hear that? But I do agree with you, you know, and I think even more so, yeah, you know, sitting there playing you know, Cream songs and Sabbath and Stray Dog and ZZ Top and, you know, Bad Company and all that, yeah, all that gets funneled through his unique you know, brain pan, and it comes out as Edward Van Halen. Right. I mean, a lot of those bands are trios. It comes from somewhere, but you know, you would never say that Edward played like, I mean, a little bit, you know, like Billy Gibbons or those types of people, but, it's just pretty amazing, you know, or why weren't there 10 other guitar players playing like Edward? You know what I mean? How does it, how does the 70s now is the era of that style of guitar playing? You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know if there's an answer to that. Do you know what I mean? Am I making sense here?
Oh, did he freeze? I think he froze.
Yeah.
Or he's really thinking.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm just tossing out things I think about. I suppose that's true with anything. You know, how is it that expressionism, or surrealism as an art, it's not like there was one guy doing it 50 years earlier. It's all, and these people are working in isolated environments. So how is it? How is it that, in 77, the Sunset Strip thing happened? Why didn't it happen 10 years earlier with different guitar players? You know what I mean? I mean, I don't even know if there's an answer for that question, but you know.
Yeah. Did you get to spend any time with Alex at all?
I spent not a lot of time, but he would be up at 5150 sometimes when I was there. I'd see him. They had these like big rehearsal. I would see him there, talk to him there. I see him backstage once in a while. And then I write famously about going on a double date with Alex. And that was a scene, man. That was fun. I didn't know Alex that well. I mean, he knew me as this writer who was always hanging out with his brother.
Yeah.
And I believe that he recognized in me someone who had Edward's back and wasn't going to write anything bad about him and, right. Cared about his brother. And so I was kind of welcome into the Van Halen fold, as it were. So, we always had a very cordial, nice relationship. And I like the guy. I mean, he was certainly the big brother. Mm. Protective of Edward. I sense that. As the way it should be, for a bigger brother.
Yeah. Did they ever, excuse me, did they ever invite you into the studio like during the recordings of any albums or anything?
Never did. No. I think that was the inner sanctum. I don't think anybody was ever there, the engineers and.
Yeah.
Producers, obviously. I was down at Sunset Sound, which I almost forgot about, but I write about in the book, and there's a conversation where either Edward brings it up or I mentioned Sunset Sound. So I was down there. And I can't remember why. I don't know if Edward was playing me tapes there or maybe they had a session that day, but no, I was never privy to fitting in on the session. That would have been pretty incredible.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Are you back now, Lou?
Yes, I have been back for about 2 minutes.
Are you unfrozen now?
I hate this MacBook. Anyways, Apple, send us new products.
Yeah, we need that. All right, go ahead. You got some more stuff?
I just have
questions for more fans.
One final question for Mr. Rosen. And that is, Steve, if you want people to find out more about you or purchase your books, where on the interweb can they go?
Oh, well, cool. Well, I am so happy to announce that after being a music journalist for, believe it or not, over 5 decades, and even since the advent of the internet and the computer, people say, oh, get a webpage, get a website. It's like, they might have been saying, dude, fly to the moon. I mean, I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how to do that. Anyway, I had a very good friend help me, Ron Brahe, put together a webpage where you can find the book. There's some cool pictures up there. You can find out a little bit more about me and things I've done. And that address is very simple, tonechaserbook.com. All one word, no spaces, tonechaserbook.com. You can also find the book on Amazon, eBay, Reverb, and Etsy. If anybody ever goes to Etsy and you're shopping for a homemade purse, go look up my book. And
I think that's where I got this shirt.
Seriously?
Oh yeah, Etsy's they actually have some pretty cool stuff on there.
Oh, like wow.
Rock and metal related.
Oh, yeah. Wow, cool. Yeah, so you can find the book there. And actually, I this is the first time I'm announcing this. I hate to say this, but you know, due to rising costs, my book on my site, which is now $35, on November 1st, it will go up to $41.99. Like everything else in this world, man, things just got more expensive. But if you, you know, if you have any interest, you can still go find the book and up until November 1st for $35. And yeah, so hope you go and check it out.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, it, like you said, the prices have gone up everywhere. Are you offering the book autographed on your website, or can people ask you to autograph it?
You know, man, I originally thought, well, I'm going to autograph all the books. And then one person said something, oh, I wish you had an autograph. So I said, okay. So now, yes, if you request an autograph, I will happily autograph it. I will personalize it. You know, wives have bought copies for husband's birthdays and mentioned the birthday. And I love doing that. I'll happily do that, you know, but just put in the request and I will happily sign it for you.
Very cool.
Yeah. And seriously, everybody, I mean, you know, when we have authors on Ratsaw Review, we try not to just have anyone who's publishing. We don't want anyone who does a smear book or, you know, talks crap about people. You know, we really try to do our pick of the litter of finding good authors and good books. And I have to, and this is not to knock anyone that we've had on the show. You know, we've had Lorelei Shellest, who was the former fiance of Def Leppard Steve Clark. We've had Michelle Kutch, who wrote the Hypothesis of Giants book. We had William, the philosophy teacher who did the Metallica book. Oh, I'm William sorry, Irwin. Will, I forgot your last name.
Irwin.
William Irwin. Thank you. But you know, as someone who loves history, especially musical history, this is one of the best books that I've ever freaking read. And you know, I just felt really engulfed in reading it. You know, reading about one of my heroes. You know, and like, is it a smear piece? No. Is it a pretty picture? Is real life a pretty picture? No, it's not.
It's a realistic picture,
but it's an honest picture. And you know what? You'll come away from it learning a lot about Eddie and possibly something about yourself. You know, what would you do if you were in that situation?
Yeah. That is so beautiful, man. Seriously, I'm so touched by that. I mean, that is really, really nice. I mean, look, you sit down to write a book, you're in a room by yourself for 14 months, and it was hard to write. I mean, I've written other books previously. I wrote a book on Jeff Beck, in fact, his first biography, which came out in Japan only. Nonetheless, I wrote a book on Sabbath, Randy Rhoads, Prince, Springsteen. Those books were done, honestly, man, 3 or 4 months maybe. I'm not trying to give myself a pat on the back, but it was a really difficult book to write. And you said earlier, what do I want people to come away with? Exactly what you just said. That's what I want. You know, that is such a nice compliment, and to be compared to those other writers and the insightful books that they wrote is fantastic. And yeah, man, that was critical to me, because at the end of the day, I've got this book, and you know, before anybody reads it, it's the greatest novel ever written, right? Before anybody ever hears your song or you as a guitar player, Lou, you're the greatest guitar player on the planet, you know. So when you go out there and you step on the club stage, and man, they hear your song, and that's when reality sets in. So I'm there with that book, you know, and I get the book printed, and it goes out, and you're thinking, my God, you know, did I do the right thing? You know, I brought everything I had to bear. I wrote the best book I possibly could, but you never know. And so, yeah, man, to hear your response, obviously you're a very learned individual. You've talked to a lot of wonderful writers and musicians and insights, and you know books, and So for you to say that, it tells me I did my job and I did it really well. So
you knocked it out of the park, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you, man.
And then you mentioned how you were a guitar player in and out the book. Did you ever get to start a band? Did you ever get to do any?
Oh, Wayne, you're digging into my heart.
Would you like to buy any of mine?
Oh, God. I need to probably take guitar lessons from Lou. You know, man, probably pig-headed thinking about it. I always thought I was a better guitar player and songwriter than I was a journalist. But I could never, ever, put a band together for any length of time, much less make a living as a guitar player. You know, I did some, played some clubs back in the day, and I write about it. Had various bands, you know, and found musicians. Man, that's just a hard road. Again, I can believe I was a better guitar player and songwriter than I was a journalist. The reality is 50 years later, I'm still writing stories and writing books, you know, and that guitar career ended years ago. I mean, I still play, and my brother actually plays drums, you know, jam and go play them somewhere. But, let me mention one thing. Mm-hmm. I did put together a project called Highway Sentinels. To make a long story short, I've been writing songs with my buddy Jimmy Waldo.
Jimmy Waldo of Alcatraz.
Yes.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And if you ever want to speak to Jimmy, he would love to talk to you guys.
Oh, yes, that would be awesome.
Great. And I don't know if you know about my famous Yngwie Malmsteen story about punching Yngwie.
No, but you better tell it.
or we could have Jimmy on the show and he could tell it.
Yeah, Jimmy could tell. Jimmy was there that night.
That is Jimmy's story to tell.
Exactly. So Jimmy and I have been writing songs for years. Jimmy's manager, Giles Avery, Lavery, I'm sorry. Here's the songs, thinks they're really cool songs. He says, hey, man, update the songs a little bit, you know, modernize them. I can go get you a deal. I know this singer, David Reese. David Reese was the singer in Accept,
yep.
Latter version, really, really good singer. So to make a long story short, these songs originally had singers on them when we wrote the songs back in the day, and I wrote lyrics. All the lyrics and melodies are stripped. I sort of updated the songs, and I had brought in some of my buddies to actually play some guitar parts. Pete Howland, who went on to play guitar in Chicago, Harry Cody, who was in a band called Shaka Messiah, great guitar player.
Yes, yes.
Tony Guardian, a great Christian band. Tony Palacios, amazing guitar player. So I'm sort of on there back playing guitars with these guys back in the 80s. Updated to, I guess the record's been out about a year. We bring in David Reese. We send him the track. He puts on new lyrics, new vocals. And then I called on some other friends, guys I'd interviewed, to put on solos. So I reached out, I'm going to reach out to Joe Satriani. I've interviewed him 15 times. He'll put a solo on. Like Joe Satriani is going to find time to put a solo on my record. Man, he emailed me 5 minutes later, send me the track. 2 weeks later, he sends back his solo. Uh-huh. What can I say? I mean, reach out to Joe Satriani, Tracy Gunn, Paul Gilbert, Bumblefoot, Joe Stump.
Who is now the guitarist in Alcatraz? Joe Stump is now the guitarist in Alcatraz.
Exactly.
Crazy.
Unbelievable guitar player. I put on a solo, and I wrote all these guys. Guys, listen. Don't be jealous of my solo. Don't be afraid I'm going to blow you away. But, you know, right. So anyway, man, Highway Sentinels, you know, it's a really cool project.
The Waiting Fire. It's available on streaming media.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just added it. I'm going to listen to this.
Very nice. So, yeah, man, so that's my little claim to rock and roll fame, you know. So.
Very cool. All right. All right.
I'm excited. This is so cool.
Nice.
Yeah, you have to give us the contact for the Alcatraz thing. That'd be really cool.
No, Alcatraz keyboardist, Jimmy Wolf.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yep. All right. Well, Steve, thank you very much for coming on the show. I'm glad you contacted me on LinkedIn, something that I really never, ever go on. It just happened to go on there, and then I got your message. So I'm glad you got a hold of me.
That's great, man. I look at LinkedIn. I had an account. I didn't even know I had an account. So you meant, podcast. Okay, you know, yeah. So figuring either they're never going to respond or there's flakes on the other end. I don't know. But yeah, man, me too. Very happy. I really appreciate your time and the respect you've shown me, man.
No problem. Well deserved. And you should try to reach out to the Dave and Dave Unchained podcast.
I actually did one way back in the day.
Oh, well, I wish I'd heard it then. Okay, I got to listen to that.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Yeah, no, this was, I think, back in the first edition. And, those guys are great. I mean, man.
Yeah, the Long Island boys, like Wayne and me. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Nope, Steve, again, thank you very much for coming on the show. And go, please go order that book, tonechaserbook.com, and go to ratsatreview.com, and also hit subscribe here on YouTube, and go check out the podcast version on, like we mentioned before, Pandora, because it's huge, Spotify, apparently. iTunes, Amazon, anywhere else you can hear podcasts. So hit that subscribe button, give us some comments, and then we'll see you here next week.
And don't forget to go to severedangel.com and pick up a CD. Okay.
That's right.
New album coming soon because it's been finished for over a year. And next week we'll be back. Are we doing the Ozzy discography?
Maybe we should send Steve a CD.
I'd love to send Steve a CD. Absolutely. And then he could brutalize it on the internet. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Steve, after we get off the air, let's give us your address. We'll send you a copy.
Excellent.
All right. Demone, everybody. Yes, see you next week. Ozzy Discography.
Thank you. All right. See you then. Bye-bye.
Demone.